नारायणं नमस्कृत्यम् नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासम् ततो जयमुदीरयत् नस्तप्रेषु भद्रेषु नित्यं भवतु सेवया भगवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्ति भवति नैस्तिकी ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Reading today from Canto 5, Chapter 1, called The Activities of Maharaj Priyavrata, and reading today from text number 7. As you can see, we all have very esoteric knowledge. I think it's because it's irregular verse. Am I right? Okay. I'll just read the Sanskrit then, and then we'll repeat the word for word. Atah Bhagavan Adideva Itasya Guna Visargasya Paribrahmananudhyaya Vyavasita Shakala Jaga Adiprata Atma Yonir Akila Nigamani Jagana Parivestitaha sva bhavanad avatatara. Ata. Thus. Ha. Indeed. Bhagavata. My mistake. Bhagavan. The most powerful. Adidevaha. The first demigod. Etasya. Of this universe. Gunavisargasya. The creation of the three modes of material nature. Paribrahmana. The welfare. Anudhyana. Always thinking of. Vyavasita. Known. Sakala, whole, jagat, of the universe, abhipraya, by whom, the ultimate purpose, atma, the supreme self, yonihi, whose source of birth, akila, all, Nigama, by the Vedas. Nijagana, by personal associates. Pariveshtitaha, being surrounded. Svabhavanat, from his own abode. Avatatara, descended. Translation. Shri Shukadev Goswami continued, the first created being and most powerful demigod in this universe is Lord Brahma, who is always responsible for developing universal affairs. Born directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he dedicates his activities to the welfare of the entire universe. For he knows the purpose of the universal creation. This supremely powerful Lord Brahma, accompanied by his associates in the personified Vedas, left his own abode in the higher planetary system and descended to the place of Prince Priyavrata's meditation. I'll read that again. I don't think we'll repeat. It's a bit long. Let me read it one more time. Shri Shukadev Goswami continued, The first created being and most powerful demigod in the universe is Lord Brahma, who is always responsible for developing universal affairs. Born directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he dedicates his activities to the welfare of the entire universe, for he knows the purpose of the universal creation. This supremely powerful Lord Brahma, accompanied by his associates and by the personified Vedas, left his own abode in the higher planetary system and descended to the place of Prince Priyavrata's meditation. Purport. Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Self, Atma, is the source of everything, as explained in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmadyasya Yataha. Because Brahma was born directly from Lord Vishnu, he is called Atma Yoni. He is also called Bhagavan. Although generally Bhagavan refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, or Lord Krishna, sometimes great personalities such as demigods like Lord Brahma, Narada, or Lord Shiva are also addressed as Bhagavan because they carry out the purpose of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why are they called Bhagavan? Yes, why is Narada, Shiva, and Lord Brahma called Bhagavan?
Because they carry out the purpose of the Lord. They are serving
him. That's good. Just checking if you're listening. Because they carry out the purpose of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yeah. Lord Brahma is called Bhagavan because he is the secondary creator of this universe. He is always thinking of how to improve the situation of the conditioned souls who have come to the material world to enjoy material activities. For this reason, he disseminates the Vedic knowledge throughout the universe for everyone's guidance. Vedic knowledge is divided into two parts, Pravritti Marga and Nirvritti Marga. Nirvritti Marga is the path of negating sense enjoyment, and Pravritti Marga is the path by which the living entities are given a chance to enjoy, and at the same time are directed in such a way that they can go back home, back to Godhead. Because ruling over this universe is a great responsibility, Brahma must force many Manus in different ages to take charge of universal affairs. Under each Manu, there are different kings who also execute the purpose of Lord Brahma. It is understood from previous explanations that the father of Dhruva Maharaj, King Uttanapad, ruled over the universe because his elder brother, Priyavrata, practiced austerity from the very beginning of his life. Thus, up to the point of the Prachetas, the kings of the universe were all descendants of Uttanapada. Since there were no suitable kings after the Prachetas, Svayambhuva Manu went to the Gundamadana hill to bring back his eldest son, Priyavrata, who was meditating there. Svayambhuva Manu requested Priyavrata to rule over the universe. When he refused, Lord Brahma descended from the supreme planetary system known as Satyaloka to request Priyavrata to accept the order. Lord Brahma did not come alone. He came with other great sages like Marichi, Atreya, and Vashishta. To convince Priyavrata that it was necessary for him to follow the Vedic injunctions and accept the responsibility of ruling over the world, which means the universe, I think, Lord Brahma also brought with him the personified Vedas, his constant associates. A significant word in this verse is Swabhavanat, indicating that Lord Brahma descended from his own abode. Every demigod has his own abode. Indra, the king of the demigods, has his own abode, as do Chandra, the lord of the moon planet, and Surya, the predominating deity of the sun planet. There are many millions of demigods, and the stars and planets are their respective homes. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Yanti Deva Vrita Devan. Those who worship the demigods go to their different planetary systems. Lord Brahma's abode, the highest planetary system, is called Satyaloka, or sometimes Brahmaloka. Brahmaloka usually refers to the spiritual world. The abode of Lord Brahma is Satyaloka, but because Lord Brahma resides there, it is also sometimes called Brahmaloka. Srila Shukadeva Goswami continued, "The first created being and most powerful demigod in this universe is Lord Brahma, who is always responsible for developing universal affairs. Born directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he dedicates his activities to the welfare of the entire universe, for he knows the purpose of the universal creation. This supremely powerful Lord Brahma, accompanied by his associates and the personified Vedas, left his own abode in the higher planetary system and descended to the place of Priyavrata's meditation. Omagyana Timalandasya Janandana Shalakaya Chakshura Militangyena Tasmai Shi Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpaturubhisya Kripa Sindhubhivata Pritanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasini Gaura Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Ram Ram Hare Hare. It's a long verse in purport. What's the theme of this? What is the theme? You're wondering now if I'm really asking you, aren't you? But I want you to think. Sometimes it's easier if it's a shorter purport. We have less to choose from. And how is this relevant to us, this purport? Knowledge is to be not only understood, but internalized. It's interesting how the Vedas are personified. Veda means knowledge, so actually there are, knowledge is actually ultimately personal. It's living. It's not a dead commodity as it's often treated these days. We won't digress on that, but we do need to look at this and see how it's relevant. One sentence stood out for me, and that was, or is, because ruling over this universe is a great responsibility, Brahma must force many Manus in different ages to take charge of universal affairs. It seems that leadership posts are not desirable for many, particularly those on the path of Nivritti Marg, the path of renunciation. Two paths, Pravritti Marg, Nivritti Marg. It's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, verse 1, chapter 4. It's explained there, Nivritti Tarishaya. Nivritti means giving up. Tarishaya here means lust, giving up lust, or becoming released, Srila Prabhupada says, from lust or material activities. Srila Prabhupada further explains, in the life of animals and demons, there is no conception of Nivritti Marg, nor is there any conception of Pravritti Marg. Pravritti Marg maintains that even though one has the propensity for sense gratification, he or she can gratify his or her senses according to the directions of the Vedic injunctions. So Pravritti Marg shouldn't be taken just to mean any kind of materialistic activities, but they are those activities according to the Vedic injunctions. Now there are elaborate debates about what constitutes Nivritti Marg and to whether Krishna consciousness is Nivritti Marg, but the correct understanding of that. But what this discussion really, in this whole chapter, it seems to revolve around what is the real meaning of Nivritti. And I'm going to draw another kind of theme from this. This is a common theme, what real renunciation is. What is the real path of getting out of the material world rather than being engaged with the material world? But I'm going to develop another theme, if I can, in the time we have available. So there's a lot of questions here about what is that release from lust, and what's the process for becoming free from lust? But here it's interesting that those generally who are on the Nirvritti Marg are often reluctant to accept material posts. If I were to ask the question here, which would you prefer, to take on the role of a Kshatriya or an administrator or perhaps a temple president, or you'd rather be a Brahmin, my guess is that the response would be, I'd rather be a Brahmin. Am I right? Could I ask, is there anyone here who would make another response? Ride Chaitanya is looking in a year or two for a replacement. Actually, in the early days of ISKCON, there was practically when one temple president went, there was a kind of queue at his door for who wanted to be temple president. These days, it tends to be rather difficult to find. Why? Because generally speaking, it's troublesome. That's true. But here we see, no, the Manus are being forced. Let's discuss this. I mean, even in general society beyond ISKCON, there is a lot of concern that there is a suitable leader. There are many debates about, even now I think, I haven't read the news for a little while, but our friend Colonel Gaddafi in Libya is threatened, and I think the West or NATO is trying to depose him at the moment, and they're giving the reasons that he's not qualified to be a leader, because he has actually killed many of his own people. So those debates go on in outside society. As you may know, there is a very special wedding coming up soon in the UK called the Royal Wedding, where I think Prince, is it William or Harry? I think it's Prince William, is getting married to Kate Middleton. And a few days ago, in true British manner, because we're very concerned with class, and aristocracy and all those issues, there was a whole family tree of his spouse-to-be, Kate Middleton, and it was revealed that many of her ancestors were, I'm sorry to say, coal miners. So there's a lot of debate on these issues. Of course, now it's become, I mean, some years ago, that would have not been acceptable, with a more perhaps liberal approach towards class issues and caste issues, I may say, then these things aren't so important. But there are still discussions, debates on this, very much so. But what is the perspective from the Krishna conscious perspective? And here we see that King Priyavrata is actually descending to, King Lord Brahma is descending to ask Priyavrata to take the throne. Actually, he was to have, as we'll hear later, 10 children by one wife. That means he was engaged in sex life, obviously. And three by another wife, a second wife. So, I mean, he was engaged in appeared to be materialistic activities. Three of those sons, the last three by his second wife, all accepted the post of Manu, interestingly. So it's relevant to this purport. But it's explained here that the whole function is in connection with the purposes of the universe. Rulership is connected to the purpose of the universe. And the position of rulership is ultimately, as Lord Brahma is showing, for the dissemination of knowledge, or nirvritti tarshaya, getting rid of lust. That's the purpose. Notice how there's quite a different, concept of knowledge, what it actually is. This is also explained very clearly in the Bhagavad Gita. The third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, of course, explains karma yoga, particularly that where one is following the system of Varnashram, where one is performing one's obligatory duties. And towards the end of the chapter, the Lord explains what it is that actually deviates us from our particular duties. What is it that causes us to, on occasion, give up or be distracted from our duties? I think we all have experience occasionally where we're distracted for some reason from unmotivated and uninterrupted devotional service. Occasionally. Yes? We do have experience, don't we? Actually, we're engaging practically with these issues in as we practice devotional service. It's a fact. It's a very practical process. And it's based on experience, knowledge. We have experience of what's spoken here. Shri Bhagavanu Vacha Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavanaham Avyayam Vivaswan Manave Prahar Manorikshvakare Bravit. Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Shri Krishna, said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivaswan, and Vivaswan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshvaku. Purport. Well, this is a part of the purport. Herein we find the history of the Bhagavad Gita traced from a remote time when it was delivered to the royal order of all planets, beginning from the sun planet. The kings of all planets are especially meant for the protection of the inhabitants, and therefore the royal order should understand the science of Bhagavad Gita in order to be able to rule the citizens and to protect them from the bondage of lust. Human life is meant for the cultivation of spiritual knowledge. See how Srila Prabhupada here explains how knowledge and lust are pretty well the opposite. Human life is meant for the cultivation of spiritual knowledge in eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the executive heads of all states and all planets are obliged to impart this lesson to the citizens by education, culture, and devotion. Interesting. Three items: education, culture, and devotion. In other words, the executive heads of all states are intended to spread the science of Krishna consciousness so that people may take advantage of this great science and pursue a successful path. We are meant for success. Successful path, utilizing the opportunity of the human form of life. So really the point is, well, why can't knowledge just be imparted by Brahmins? They're the ones who normally impart the knowledge. They're the teachers. Once Srila Prabhupada was asked on a lecture, what will the Brahmins do in our society? Or what do Brahmins do in a society? Srila Prabhupada responded, they're teachers. They teach. Of course, they're also engaged in worship, and they teach worship also. But one of the main functions is to teach. So why is it that we need kings and people like that? And what is the purport here? Two key points. One, that two answers to this. One, education must be systematic, not just whimsical. There is a misconception, and it is sometimes there in ISKCON also, that spiritual life has no form. We don't plan in spiritual life. I read an article in the Bhagavad Gita, Why Devotees Don't Make Plans. The best lectures are spontaneous. We might be careful to differentiate spontaneity from whim. Are we being spontaneous, or are we being whimsical? What is the first purpose of ISKCON? What is the first purpose of ISKCON? How many of us consider ourselves members of ISKCON? Raise it, show of hands. Let's do it properly. A proper raise of hands. Who consider their members of ISKCON? Yes, we put two hands up. What's the first purpose of ISKCON? Yes. No. Yes and no. But Srila Prabhupada wrote seven purposes when he incorporated ISKCON in New York. Mataji. Two? That's a summary of it. Well done. That's good. Who knows it in full? Huh? To systematically propagate spiritual knowledge and to educate all peoples in the techniques of spiritual life in order to address the imbalance of values in the world and to bring peace and harmony to the world. Mm-hmm. Why don't we know it? We've been in ISKCON for a number of years. It's very, actually, if you ever get a chance, and we're not going to do it now because we don't have time, but if we analyze this verse, it really is got a lot of stress on education. And it says to systematically propagate spiritual knowledge and to educate all peoples in the techniques of spiritual life. The second word is systematically. Mm-hmm. It should be systematic. In the outside world, they call that formal education. It just means systematic. Formal education doesn't mean you wear a tie. It just means systematic education, generally speaking. That's the first point. Education should be systematic. Second, there must also be an effective administrative leader and a society conducive to spiritual life. So there are various perspectives here, and we're coming to the theme here. The first perspective is that religion is all about this world. Actually, you should read the Bhaktivedanta College brochure. You've seen there's a new brochure for Bhaktivedanta College. If you want to distribute some of them, please do. But you'll see there's a little typographical error, and it says that students learn about world regions. Anyway, it's an error, no problem. Of course, it should be world religions. When I was meditating, well, often we kind of confuse the two. A lot of religion is based on, and this is the Pravritti Marg, or the Karma Marg, we identify religion with our material identity, with the self, with the family, with the country. There are many examples of this. If you go into where I stay in the UK often, there's a nice little cute English church, and flying on top of it is the St. George flag. You know, the red cross on a white background. I think in Greece, where my wife is from, also religion has become very, very strongly associated with the national identity to such an extent that when the European Union, of which I think Greece is now an honorable member, when they requested that they actually remove from the identity card to make that identity card consistent with European rules and standards, when they asked them to remove the statement of the person's religion on that identity card, the Greek Orthodox Church objected very strongly and protested. It must be on the identity. Is that right? It must be on the identity. So you see this. I mean, there are reasons behind this, because Greece was actually under the Ottoman Empire for over 400 years, and there was a lot of suppression, and therefore the national and religion became a source of resistance and a resource of strengths against the opponents. But still, whatever the reason, we see that religion easily becomes identified with our family life and so on. In fact, if you read many books these days on religion, It's often advertised as something that builds community and strengthens community. Pravritti Marg. There's another example. In the editorial, we may think that Hinduism is free from this. But there's one editorial in the Hinduism Today magazine. You may know that Hinduism Today magazine. It's put out by a Shaivite tradition who has many American followers, converts, if you like. And they were actually writing about ISKCON in this article, interestingly enough. But it finished up, and listen to this. India alone can save India, and India and Hinduism are one. Kind of extension of the Advaita philosophy there. That was in a magazine in 1998. And even sometimes in Christianity, some theologians suggest that Christ's role was primarily social liberation. So we have the historical Christ who is teaching us how to fight repressive regimes like the Romans. And we have liberation theology and so on particularly in South America, I think that developed. So there's often this tendency that religion is tied up with the family and improving our lot in this world. The second tendency is to separate religion and religious experience from all its social trappings. And there are many good reasons. Religion tends to have a pretty bad name, bad press these days. Particularly when the clergy and the Brahmins have become enamored by the trappings of the royal order. I think it was Voltaire during the French Revolution said that human society will not be happy until the last priest is strangled with the entrails of the last king. Nice people. But this was some of the anger and the resentment that has brewed up against religion, with what religion has done. In a sense, if we look at the history of religion, we can sometimes understand the revulsion that people have with it. Of course, the mistake is one to think that actually perhaps there's no good religion, and to view all religion in terms of their own experience of perhaps more, whatever religions they are. And the second, of course, is to think that actually because human beings have done so much wrong, there is no God. That's another mistake. I think our friend Richard Dawkins tends to make that mistake a lot. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also gave the example. He wouldn't associate with Maharaj Prataparudra. He wouldn't even meet him, because there is that danger that the clergy, the priesthood, becomes enamored by that wealth and position. And it's so easily done. When we have material wealth or position and we don't understand some of the sufferings that others are undergoing, it's easy to get a different perspective on the world, that it seems pretty good. And it's natural that if we do have, say, wealth, and we're given the option between something that's comfortable or uncomfortable, we generally take the more comfortable means, don't we? It's natural, just by contact. So what are the symptoms of this revulsion of world religion? I've listed a few here. We now have a secular society where religion is separated from politics. We also have the idea, very common idea, and this is the one I really want to focus on, I don't believe in organized religion. I did hear one ISKCON guru who responded to that by saying, "What do you want? Disorganized religion?" There's also a movement towards spirituality rather than just religion. People are talking about your own spirituality. That word is used a lot. Sometimes we see the rejection of religious institutions, and that includes rejecting ISKCON. We've come across that? Rejecting the institution, but keeping our Krishna consciousness. And I've got another one here. Perhaps the establishment of an alternative Sangha that claims not to be an institution. which is relatively easy when you're a small group, but as soon as you have a group and it gets bigger, it inevitably becomes an institution, a society. Those challenges will always be there. You can't avoid them. So on one hand, we've got worldly religions often associated with Karmakanda, and the second is this kind of rejection of this kind of more popular society-based religion or politics-related religion by those who are a little more thoughtful. To some degree, this is probably associated with the ascetic traditions, with the Shramana tradition rather than the Brahminical tradition, and with the paths of jnana and yoga. So what about our own tradition? What's our stance on this? No organized religion. What is our attitude towards organized religion? First, I've got 4 points. One, it rejects religious identification based on the body. That's clear. Yasyatma buddhi kunupe tudatu kes vadi kalitradishi boma idyadi yatirtha buddhi salile nakarichit janishvabhigeshu saeva gokaraha. This is favored by heavy preachers. One who identifies his self as the inert body composed of mucus, bile, and air. Rather graphic, but really what it's doing is referring to the Ayurvedic idea of the body, the tridosha. That's why it says these three things. It's not really trying to make us disgusted with the material body, I don't think. I think it's more based on that. So we think that the body is the self. I identify with the body. Then what happens next? He assumes his wife and family are permanently his own. They belong to me. I desire a permanent relationship. And therefore we find in religion the idea among some that when we die, we'll all go back to heaven. There are questions about this, such as, how old will my grandmother be when we meet again? Will the dog be there? Will he be vegetarian? There are some questions, and many kind of think there's a degree of wishful thinking in this. Even in the Hindu tradition, there are some sections who say that with the right marriage and performance of rites, one will keep one's husband or wife for 7 births or something like that. I'm not going to ask you whether you're happy or not with that. But anyway, that's another thing. I won't go there. I'll get in trouble with my wife. Next point. One sees a place of pilgrimage merely as taking a bath there. So it becomes ritualistic. It's interesting. I lived in Oxford. It was great. Oh, it's great. You tell people I live in Oxford, they know where it is, got prestige. It's very good for the full seeker. But you see all these American tourists, Chinese tourists, and they're all coming. And then we're in Oxford. We never go and look at the places they look at. We never go. Why? Because if you're a tourist, you've got to be somewhere else. Similarly with pilgrimage. We go miles to bathe in the Ganga, but we forget that maybe we're living here in Radhadesh, Krishna's here, or whatever. There's that tendency. But who never identifies himself with, or feels kinship with, or worships those who are wise in spiritual truth. Such a person is no better than an ass or a cow. There are reasons why he's called an ass or a cow. It's not just a kind of pejorative term. But let's move on. The most important point here is we don't identify with the body. But a second point is made, associating with spiritual people. So sadhu sangha is part of our tradition. Not just necessarily for an 11th of a second, lava matra, but continuous association, sadhu sangha. So we really should associate with others. It's not to be by ourselves. But of course, sadhu sangha can be in a disorganized form. We just meet sadhus whenever we meet. We don't need organized religion. We just meet sadhus now and again. Third point. Srila Prabhupada explains why ISKCON was established. Notice how he extends the idea of sadhu sangha. Srila Narottam Das Thakur has therefore advised us to live only in the association of Krishna conscious devotees, Bhakta Sannivas. One should always engage in the service of the Lord in the association of the Lord's devotees. Association with those engaged in a similar line of business is very conducive to the advancement of that business. Consequently, materialistic persons form various associations and clubs to enhance their endeavors. For example, in the business world, we find such institutions as the stock exchange and the chamber of commerce. Similarly, we have established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness to give people an opportunity to associate with those who have not forgotten Krishna. This spiritual association offered by our ISKCON movement is increasing day by day. Many people from different parts of the world are joining the society to awaken their dormant Krishna consciousness. And there's another quote also from there, if I can find it. Page 4, page 5, here. This Krishna consciousness movement offers a spiritual community that can bring about a peaceful condition in the world. Every intelligent man should purify his consciousness and rid himself of the above-mentioned six hindrances, the six obstacles to devotional service, by taking wholehearted shelter of this Krishna consciousness movement. So we've actually seen, first, Krishna consciousness rejects worldly religions based on the body. Secondly, it recommends the association of sadhus, sadhu sangha. And thirdly, under the guidance of Rupa Goswami, as Srila Prabhupada states in the preface to the Nectar of Instruction, we have a society called ISKCON with its GBC and other leaders and managers. And the fourth point is coming back here. We have all these examples of devotees who are requested or compelled to take administrative positions. Maharaj Yudhisthira also really didn't want to take up the throne of the world. We have the example of Prithu Maharaj, who replaced King Vena. And actually the Brahmins killed King Vena. Brahmins never kill. Prabhupada explains in the lecture, he said they never normally kill. They bring in the Kshatriyas, and there are many stories about this. But on this occasion, they went to the forest, these little skinny Brahmins, big powerful King Vena. They took out their Brahmin threads, touched water, and they chanted a mantra, hum, H-U-M. Zap! Thunderbolt came and killed him. They don't normally do it. Srila Prabhupada explains, why did they do that? Why did they transgress? Because the business of the Brahmin is to protect society and give them spiritual knowledge. They were so concerned for the welfare of the people that they were prepared to transgress their own dharma. Therefore, they were really Brahmins. This gives us some insight into what a Brahmin really is. So we should not think that social interaction is not important in spiritual life. Social interaction is important. And that we can just focus on spiritual and theological issues. Of course, it's helpful to be detached from those issues, and there are many examples. Even the Bhakti saints, when they grew up, they kind of ignored the fact there were Muslim rulers and so on. They got on with their spiritual life. In fact, the Hindu tradition, the Vedic tradition, is quite notable for that. People get on with their spirit. Even Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, the British are doing a good job ruling India. It's good. We can now get on with our spiritual life. And of course, Srila Prabhupada said, we have to get rid of the British. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, no. It doesn't really matter. We must actually spread Krishna consciousness. There are many examples. The point being here, and I'm going to sum up rather quickly, is that we cannot actually reject organized religion, nor can we. Should we reject ISKCON. And if there are some faults, we should try and improve it. Not that we're critics. This is wrong, that is wrong, this is wrong. Okay, so would you like to come and help? Maybe you should be the leader. Oh, no, I'm not a leader. But if you've got superior knowledge, then you must be able to apply it. So we should give up this criticism. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was very heavy on this. Confucius, in his Analects, says, "I have two wonderful companions. One is this saintly person whose qualities I glorify, and I try and get those qualities. The second is this companion who I dislike, and I try and remove all the faults I see in him from myself." Interesting statement. We could meditate on that. So Lord Brahma is setting the example. He is a Vaishnav. He is always, and I quote, "He is always thinking of how to improve the situation of the conditioned souls who have come to the material world to enjoy material activities." So he is called Bhagavan. Actually, one who is fulfilled can become compassionate. It's no good saying, "I want to help the poor, but I have no money." Similarly, one has to have some, be full in Krishna consciousness, Bhagavan, full of opulence. He forces the Manus to take up administrative leadership. My conclusion is that actually we shouldn't give up ISKCON, but we should all become leaders in some role, even if we don't want to. Questions? Comments? Mataji.
So I think maybe in the West, when they criticize religion, they are thinking about Christianity and they forget about all the others.
No, absolutely. There's a tendency, particularly in the West, to respond to the Abrahamic religions and not consider other notions of religion, quite different concepts, and other concepts of God also. There does tend to be the Abrahamic traditions. When I was studying Christianity at university, they said that Christianity inherited a certain exclusivism from Judaism. And of course, Judaism tends to be, although it's got its mystical aspects, it tends to be quite family-based, worldly-based. What are they going to do if they start a movement of militant atheism? Yeah, there are people trying to do this. I mean, the question ultimately is whether or not there is a God. We should be very careful to avoid these debates, because that's the real question, philosophically. Is there or is there not a God? And it's clear that whatever man has done in the name of religion doesn't actually change the truth of whether there is a God. And of course, we probably have to offer some alternative means, you know, ideas of religion and God. What is it? We sometimes say there's a common expression, "I don't believe in the, I also don't believe in the God you don't believe in." Gopal Hari. And then, over here. You never transcend. Because if we think we transcend, if we think I've transcended, we're thinking I'm a Vaishnav. Vaishnavs are transcendental. And Srila Prabhupada says in one lecture, "We do not think we're a Vaishnav. We are not so impudent." He uses the word impudent. That's fine. A Vaishnav is above these things. But actually, we should be very, very careful. First, about thinking we're a Vaishnav. But second, we should look at the example of Lord Krishna, who's stating that I follow anyway. Even though I'm detached, I still follow the rules and regulations. Because if I didn't, the whole world would go to hell. It gives the example of Janak Maharaj, who's also a liberated soul, but followed his duties. So if Krishna follows, if Janak Maharaj follows, where's the Where is the room for transcending duties? That's the question I've got there. Of course, there is the concept of avaduta. We see, I mean, there's some devotees in ISKCON, you kind of go, he's an avaduta. but the Vedic injunction is no, we practice to set the example. So the idea of becoming transcendental, we need to be very, very careful as to properly understanding what that means. And if you read Srila Prabhupada's books, he over and over again makes the point explicitly or implicitly that we need an organization. And therefore we should be very, very careful about becoming critical. I mean, institutions have problems. I mean, go to a new temple, you'll think it's great for a few weeks, but stay there for 6 months, you'll find there's some politics. What's the big surprise? That's institutions. There will always be some. But let's try and improve and set an example for others. Two more points, and I'm going to finish in 3 minutes. I'm going to answer quickly.
Regarding the purport, I was kind of bewildered because you said the term Bhagavan is attributed to people who are, you know, carrying out the Christian God. But there are like different sacred texts which different people think that is the truth. So there are actually different kind of people who are carrying out the order of like different scriptures. So, and I guess this is the reason, one of the reasons why people call themselves Bhagavan in India, and there are so many Bhagavans, and maybe that's the conception why they think they are God, and they are actually like speaking, you know, God's message, and that's the reason why they are God. And wouldn't that be kind of like confusing for people?
It is. You're right. Very confusing. That's why they follow some of them who are not genuine. It's confusing. But Srila Prabhupada was giving some guidelines, one of which the he gives some guidelines. Those who carry out the purpose of the Supreme Personality of God, it can also be called Bhagavan. So we have to use our discretion. We do anyway. Spiritual life is confusing. We're in Maya. So confusion, is it? Confusion means there's an opportunity to learn. One last question.
Well, I just wanted to say that I read some article about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati where he says that in this damn world it's impossible to make real spiritual movement.
He may have done. I don't know. I've not seen that. There's always going to be some imperfection. Don't expect utopia, but expect a far better society than we can find amongst those who have not got that devotional mentality. And if it needs improving, let's improve it. We've got a lot to do. I'll finish there. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai, Gaura Premanandi Haribol.